This is Patty Prickett, and I'm interviewing Rebecca Holland Goldberg. The interview took place on November 19, 1974, at 11 a.m. in her home in Los Angeles. In this interview, we talked about Brooklyn Labor College, where she went to school in 1923, her experiences in the Women's Trade Union League and in the Joint Board in Chicago. We also talked about the Chicago General Dressmaker Strike in 1917, the 19 Shaw Clothmaker Strike, the New York General Strike in 1921, and the 1924 Chicago General Strike. She's also gone into organizing techniques in this, and a little bit into union policy.
And a lot of my notes and papers and books were burnt. Otherwise, I would have been able to give you a lot of, things about Brooklyn. But I couldn't because all this was burned with a lot of pictures and books. Everything was burned, really, when we came there. It was at the beach. And all we were left is what we wore on ourselves with the baby, and it was about a year old. And it was a lucky thing because he was with us at the beach. You know, we lived in Venice. Otherwise, he would have been burned, too. And a friend of ours came in and put something over the hot water boiler, and the whole little house, you know, to do like burned down to ashes. We found a few little things, but there's not much really to talk about. I was going to show you the Brookwood. I had a picture left somewhere when I graduated Brookwood College. You can see the types. In there, you can really see the types of the people who were there. That's Brookwood, and this is Brookwood, and this is Brookwood. These two pictures.
That's beautiful.
And this is two women came from Puerto Rico to learn something about the labor union. So they, Mr. Dubinsky, who was at that time the president of the ILGW, wished them on me. And I couldn't find a place for them to sleep because they didn't consider themselves black, although they were, so they wouldn't go to Harlem. And I couldn't get a place for them anywhere in the city because they wouldn't accept them. In fact, I couldn't get a place for them to come into a restaurant except one on 6th Street, so I had to make food. So I had in two rooms and a foyer in the amalgamated houses. I took in the couch from the foyer, which opened up my son's room. At that time, he was about 4 years old, and they slept there. So they were with me for about 6 weeks, you know.
1934?
Yeah. And this is when they were here, these two. And now, I don't know, but the last I heard of them, they were within the union, organizing a union in Puerto Rico, these two. Now, she didn't look so terribly black, so I could have perhaps put her in, but she was entirely looking black, and I just couldn't put them in anyway. But, they were in Brookwood. And then Brinsky gave me some money. I came in and I told them that they came from Puerto Rico. They had absolutely nothing warm, no stockings, no anything. And we were in Brookwood, which was in the Westchester County, very, very cold, terribly cold. It used to go almost up to zero, you know, in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him that I need money to buy them warm underwear because, you know, it's impossible to be. So he called up downstairs and gave me, I think, $100. And I went down to Wanamaker's and I bought them warm bloomers and warm stockings and shoes and stuff like that to fit them in for the winter months because they didn't, Puerto Rico must be very warm. I was never there, but it's warm.
Yeah.
And these are the two girls. So I kept them with me all the time and took care of them.
So Brookwood was international?
Brookwood was international and interracial. And you know, Brookwood worked on two forms. It was kept up by the labor unions and by a private. Now, the Women's Trade Union League was interested in Brookwood. And also...
Women particularly in the Women's
Union? In New York, the Central Committee.
Were there any women that were more active?
Yes, they were more active. In fact, one of them just died now. What was her name? I forgot. She was the head of the of the Rheumatic Union League. She just died about 2 or 3 years ago. She's a very old woman, late in the 80s, and Mrs. Rose Wolk. And there were a few other women that I don't remember their names who used to help often monetarily, you know what I mean? But they were sort of a educational center for the working girls. You know, we used to get together and discuss strikes and stuff like that, which was very interesting. And those who were more active, of course, were, you know, giving a lot of help with that, like, for instance, myself, Mary Goff, and Silver, what was it? Anna Silver, and a few more girls that are dead a long time ago because they were much older than I was. And so the years of 22, the end of 21, 22, 23, and 20, the end of 23, of course, in September, I went to Brookwood. Now, when I came to Brookwood, A.J. Muskie was at the head of it, and
he's a special Democrat.
Well, he was nothing. He was a preacher. He was a minister. And he was a very fine person, an educated man. And his heart was with labor.
And that's why he started it.
And that's why he started it. And he made such an impression upon everywhere he came, people believed him. You know, he was really a remarkable person. And when I came there, of course, I had already more education. Now, if you take a look at the picture, you'll see that most of these people from Brookwood were people from various parts of the country, further, the country, that were just active members of unions. There were miners. We had miners. We had steel workers. We had textile workers from the south. We had two girls, textile workers. And I want to tell you like an episode which is interesting, that the girls from the south were against black, of course. Now, we had a black girl there, and she was from the textile workers from Massachusetts. But we had to work very hard together with Musty to make her understand that she should stay there. She did not want to be under the same roof with her, and she was a member of a union. She came from one of the states in the south, but we finally convinced her, and it was easy. But I think this was the first beginning of a school where they would accept blacks.
Were there racial problems other than that?
Well, this was a big racial problem, but she did well, you know, and then finally it smoothed it down. Now, this was a school where we had quite big men, like Musty, David Tsapas, and others like that, you know, who were economists, and they really knew their, well, what we studied there was, for instance, the isms. We studied anarchism, socialism, communism.
What were the politics of the people?
They had no politics. Now, I want to tell you, they were sent by their unions. Most of them were on scholarships. Some, I'd say a number of them didn't know how to read and write.
Mm.
Now, we had a man like Julius Hochman, who was at the head of the Dressmakers Union. He was a terrific orator and a great organizer. But you'd be surprised, I can say it now because he's dead, I wouldn't say it otherwise, he did not know how to write. He used to dictate to his girl in the office. But all of a sudden, when I came there, and I came there and I really came into the second year, you know, because, you know, I had education. I had 3 years of University of Wisconsin when I came in there. And Musty says to me, he says, I want to ask you a favor. You know, Julius Hochman is a very important person. He had lost his election at that time as the manager of the Dressmakers Joint Board. And he needs help because he never wrote, he never writes. Everything he did in the office was dictated. And somebody, you know, he was a great orator, he really was. I'm not going to his room, but I would advise There are, that I know, 8 people who don't know how to write and don't know how to read because they read, but they don't know what the gist of a paragraph, why are the paragraphs. So I said, if you could arrange, and if I will give you a number of names that I was in a class with, I would be willing to spend 2-3 evenings a week with them and just teach them how to read, and then with the writing will come in with that, you know. And I'll give a little more attention to Julius. So they organized a English teacher, organized a group of people, or 12, and I used to read with them. I would read a chapter, and I'd say, all right, we read this chapter, so you read this chapter. Read this chapter, tell me what do you understand by that? So they tell me, I says, write it down. And they wrote it down. Read another chapter, somebody would read another chapter. What do you get out of this chapter? I said, write it down. Before you knew, that was a review of the book, a review of the chapter, you see. So I was all year doing that with these people. Now these people, some of them were very nice boys who came from Pennsylvania, for instance, from the mines, who never went to school. They went to work in the mines when they were 12, 13 years old, and they never went to school because the school was 300 miles away from them, and there was no way of them going. Some of them, very interesting men, I'll show you on the picture, very interesting men, some of them, but they didn't know anything about reading or writing, you know, because they really never had it. So look, we did an awful lot for them in this way, that by the time they came out, almost all of them became organizers, and one of them, who did know how to read and write and did go to school but knew very little about the labor movement, I recommended him, after I got through his book, I recommended him to our international, and he is now vice president, William Ross, in Chicago. You wouldn't see, you see him on the picture there. A vice president of the international and the manager of the joint board in Philadelphia. He was in Brookwood the same time I was. So you see, this Brookwood really was very interesting because it took people who had a lot of potential that was never brought out from the South and from the minor states like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, from Alabama, from Tennessee, where they had, in Tennessee, they had a very large hosiery. And the women we had 2 women there, very nice women, but they knew very little about academic writing or reading or anything like that. They read a book, but they didn't know what they were actually reading. That's according to my understanding. They read a chapter, but they didn't know what really they got out of it. You see, why a chapter? Why a paragraph? Why do you stop and start something new? That's something that you have to teach them. Now, we had a wonderful English teacher, but she couldn't get into this, really, you see. Mm-hmm. So while I was there, that 9 or 10 months that I was in Brookwood, that's what I was doing. Every, I think, 2 times a week, I used to have a class and teach them just plain things. What do you read? What do you get out of it?
Did they teach the economists? Did they teach socialist economics?
All economics. They taught why anarchism developed. They taught the IWW theory, you know, with Haywood. Haywood, you know, at that time was very, very big in the United States. IWW was very, very spread, and they didn't understand what it was. When I asked the girl, what does that mean to you? She says, free love. No, that's not a joke, really. It's not a joke, because you see, these girls nowadays, I told a group of people here, girls, you think it's something new, you know, that they live with a man without getting married. I say, it's nothing new. In my time, when I was 18, 20 years old, there were quite a number of women who lived with men without being married. In fact, they were proud of it.
And were they Is that, were there mainly people in the IWW? Is that why they...
Well, that girl was so ignorant that this was the main thing to her life, wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
What the industrial workers of the world really meant is that the workers should have control of the government, not the politicians. This was their, Haywood's idea was that the workers are producing the goods of the world that the people live on. They have to have a say in government.
That? That sounds almost exactly what you told your economics teacher at Wisconsin.
Yes.
So did you feel close to that?
Well, I felt very close to that. I didn't belong to the IWW because I didn't belong to organizations. I was organization proud, and I didn't belong because, you know, there was a reason for it. I suppose I wasn't going with it psychologically, but there was a reason for it. My brother was very active in the Socialist Party. He was at the very top of the tops, you know. He ran for judge on the socialist ticket, and he was elected, but he couldn't take on the judgeship because he was only 27 years old, and he had to get 30. Well, anyway, I grew up in the socialist atmosphere, and because of that, I didn't have too much love for the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And the Socialist Party had an establishment. Mm-hmm. So did the Communist Party have an establishment. So did the Anarchist Party have an establishment. Maybe not so much the Anarchists, but they did. And to me, you know, I didn't like to be told what to do. I was a rebel. You see?
Yeah.
And I didn't like to belong to go to the meetings. But I carried out, I suppose, the same ideals. Now, to me, the industrial workers of the world were in my heart was closest. You see? Because they didn't have a centralized force to tell an organization in Chicago what to do, and you had to do it. And that was a very big thing at that time. Anyway, to me, this was a very big thing. I'm not too much establishment now either, you know, especially now what's going on with the establishment. But at that time, I certainly wasn't. And I was young. And I did my job, but that was it. So I was in Brookwood till 1925. And in 1925, Zygmunt called me to the office and sent me back to Chicago, and I told you that already.
Is that the strike?
We had a strike in Chicago, a general,
general strike
of the dressmakers union. And it was very bad. It was lost. And there was absolutely nobody left, and the charter was held by five clockmakers, local 100. And my job was to see whether I can put the thing together.
Were you ever blacklisted when you went back into Chicago?
No, I was never blacklisted. I went from home to home of these girls that I knew, finally created an executive.
What did you say? Were they must have been afraid. Wouldn't
they? Well, what they said was that they complained that the strike was not conducted properly. The man is dead too, the one who conducted the strike.
Isn't it where they had all the injunctions and a lot of police and private detective brutality on the strikers?
No, that's Palmer's strike you're thinking about.
But this is one.
But we had. I was dragged by the neck, for instance, to the jail. We were about 12 girls that were dragged around in the winter. The strike was in the winter. And I was dragged to the police station. All we did was sing songs all night long.
So you were there for the strike too?
Yes. And that was another strike.
Uh-oh. Which one?
Well, I'll tell them. 1917, yes, there was a strike.
February.
Right. That was the winter. Now, this was a strike in 1924. And this was a general dressmaker strike, which was lost. The issues at that time was bad conditions in the shops, mostly. People were fired. And to me, you know, by that time, I had already been active in Local 100 for some time, and to me, at that time, in my youth, the money was not so important. To me, it was the security of the job. And I talked about the security of the job, mostly. But that's the strike that when I came, of course, it was a lost strike. And, you know, when it was a lost strike, everybody disappears, and the union, the shops are going on with the workers, and that's where the workers go to work, because they have to work. And what I did was to, first of all, go to the people who were active and to their homes and try to bring them back. And we created an executive, and the international gave us back the charter.
What did you say to the people when you went to their homes, and how did they react to you?
Well, I said to the people that went to the home that a strike, losing a strike is not the worst strategy, and there are causes for that. And first of all, there is the first cause is that the organizer, the strike person who is leading the strike, is not close to his people. That's the first thing. To me, it was. Then the second thing that it was that being that he was not close to the people, he could not get a group that would sacrifice. You see. And without sacrifice, you can't win a strike. Times were bad.
And how did they respond? Were they afraid?
No, they weren't afraid. They said, Rebecca, if you think that we can organize Local 100 again, we're willing to try. And I said this, that the union will guarantee that wherever you work, you will not be fired. And we guaranteed that. And what did we do? What we did was this. While we got together the executive, which was about 18 people or 19 that I remember, we also talked to the manufacturers. Bialas, at that time, was at the head of the joint board.
Were you on the joint board then, too?
When I came back, no, I had no chance to be on the joint board. There was my union to elect me.
Oh. You're right.
I couldn't be on the joint board. I was on the joint board before I left New York.
No, I knew that.
Before I left for New York. But I couldn't be on the joint board because there was no one to elect me. Well, what I want to tell you is that it was very successful because to the first meeting, we had over, I think it was 82 or 83 people, women.
And from
different shops. Now, at the same time, while this was going on, we also approached the manufacturers. They had trouble. They had a lot of trouble after the broken strike, after the strike was lost.
How?
Well, they couldn't get any workers, was one thing. they tried to give them more money. They had no one to talk to. Everybody was afraid of them, everybody else. And they were not happy. The bosses weren't happy, you see. But we had to try to convince them that they would be much better off if there would be some kind of a union. And I don't remember the details, but I do remember that after we had the first meeting, we had a meeting of the manufacturers, where Bialas was present, I was present, another a business agent from the clockmakers was present, the secretary Schulman of the joint board of the ILGW was present, and we had a very good preliminary meeting. And once we had that, we issued a lot of leaflets. We had committees before every shop, and we organized them. And what shall I tell you? I don't remember the details, as I said. I don't remember. All I know is that in 1925 in October, when I left, and Molly Friedman came to pick my place. We had 5,000 members. The largest local in the joint board in Los Angeles was the Dressmakers Union. They had dresses, skirts. And we were very successful. Now, the Women's Trade Union League helped a lot.
It did?
Yes.
You mentioned Mrs. McCormick last time.
Well, Mrs. McCormick was social. Mrs. McCormick invited us all to a lunch to her home. Beautiful villa, but that's, I don't mean it. I don't count that at all.
Mrs. Nelson,
what was her first name? I don't remember. Who was at the head of the Women's Trade Union League, and the members of the Women's Trade Union League who were workers from the millinery, from the dressmakers, from the textiles, from the Furriers, all these women helped us out by picketing, by going to the shops, and by talking to the potential union members.
Do you remember a woman, or have you ever heard of a woman named Mrs. Lilly?
Yes.
Was she in Chicago? Or
she was in Chicago.
Did she help out?
Yes.
When you were talking about it last time, yes, you talked about Mrs. McCormick, and
why I talked about Mrs. McCormick, because Mrs. McCormick tried to give us a help by socially recognizing us, opening her doors. They had a palace, and they served the lunch, and we talked, you know, and that was.
So was there a split? I mean, were there certain women in the trade union?
No.
No? How did the women who really didn't, who were like Mrs. McCormick, fit in with the women who really...
They wanted to help us. And I said, I thought, remember what I said? Like they have cats and dogs and stuff like that. They said that they had the working girl. They wanted to help us.
But they didn't really want to...
No, they didn't understand. I didn't say they didn't want to. I don't know. They just didn't understand what it's all about.
Was that true for all the women?
Most of the rich women, yes. Not all the women.
Except Mrs. Roosevelt.
Well, Mrs. Roosevelt, and there are other women in New York, like other than Mrs. Roosevelt. You'll find it somewhere else, because I haven't got any notes. But there were other women who went around and when they had the dressmaker strike in New York, they were on the picket line with them. Mrs. Roosevelt went ahead at the show. She was the governor's wife at that time. And she wanted to know, Roosevelt was governor of New York. And she wanted to show.
Was this the, which track is that?
This is.